Go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy to get 20% off your first month of cognitive behavioural therapy, with weekly sessions online with a therapist, in addition to worksheets, a journal, meditation and yoga videos, and unlimited messaging. There's strong evidence that CBT can help people who hoard, and accessing therapy online can be affordable and accessible. Find out more and get your discount at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support. 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way, so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code ACAST to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, how are you? I am unfortunately not well this week, so rather than force my way through an episode and do it half-heartedly, I am resharing a really popular episode from the past. So even if you've listened to it before, have a re-listen to Dr. Jan Eppingstall and I talking about perfectionism and hoarding. Sorry about the absence of a new episode, and I hope to be back with you next week. Welcome to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. I am drowning in stuff and trying to find a way out. Listen as I explore the issues and delve deep as somebody profoundly affected by hoarding disorder. Find out more, including links to subscribe to the podcast, at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk, and follow me on Twitter at That Hoarder and on Facebook at facebook.com/That Hoarder. So before I get started with today's episode proper, I just wanted to drop a line to thank everybody. I remembered to check in on my reviews again, and I've got loads of really nice ones. I love you all. And I'm going to read those out gradually over the next few weeks. But then I got my first donation, and I was so touched. I was honestly so touched that somebody valued what I'm doing enough to actually give me some money, which helps so much. It helps towards the podcast hosting and equipment and all of that. So thank you, thank you, thank you. So I'm going to read out what Grace said, who gave the donation. She said, "You are so brave. I truly, deeply admire you. Sharing your story is very powerful for everyone who shares the struggle of letting go, and is also very insightful for the people around them. I stand by you climbing this mountain and celebrating the successes all the way. Thank you again so much. Now on with today's episode.
We are so lucky to have Dr. Jan Eppingstall back on the podcast and hopefully on a regular basis. Jan is a therapist who works specifically with hoarders. She has a PhD in hoarding and is an expert on all aspects of the disorder. Today, we're going to talk about perfectionism, which is something that a lot of hoarders have in common, and it can really trip us up. Lots of people would find the idea that hoarders can be perfectionists to be a bit ludicrous, to be honest. They associate perfectionism with neatness and order, and that's not always the case. How does perfectionism fit into the puzzle of hoarding?
Yeah, that's exactly. I mean, commonly people think of a perfectionist as someone who strives to achieve their best in everything that they do. You know, we imagine someone who works feverishly cleaning and has a spotless home and perfectly turned out children who are well behaved and immaculately dressed, following all the rules, ironing undies and sheets and all that kind of stuff, and just seems to do it with ease. But I just think thinking about perfectionism in this way is kind of problematic, because striving for high standards isn't inherently pathological. That's not what the problem of perfectionism is. And there are kind of three main parts to problematic perfectionism. First, you've got that demanding standards and self-criticism. Then you have striving to meet demanding standards despite negative effects, and basing self-evaluation on achieving high standards. So those are kind of the pathological kind of results of perfectionism. And I think the differences in presentation and behaviour has to do with what is at the heart of perfectionism, which is fear of failure. That is kind of the core of it. So if you look at hoarding from the perspective of those three main points, and you consider perfectionism can be around anything that's important to you, if we look at it from that way, what's important to you when you attempt to declutter? Not wasting, recycling correctly, maybe not making mistakes and throwing out something you need or want later, or someone else might need or want later. So that's that, you know, that I've got this really high standard of, you know, not wasting anything that still is of use or still has something left in it, the jar of, you know, pickles or whatever. I have to use every single bit of that up. So that's one of the things that's how kind of hoarding relates to that. It's that fear of making mistakes kind of, and hoarding work together and make sense when you look at it from that perspective.
Absolutely. I think this whole thing of, if I throw this away now, what if I need it, is a big kind of almost cliche with hoarders, isn't it? I can't get rid of this. What if I need it? But also, I can't tidy up quickly, because what if I don't think about something sufficiently and make a proper decision? Or what if I don't flick through the pages of the book, what if there's a £10 note in there? Or I think it can really trip you up in so many ways. And I think that relates to kind of, I remember when I first heard of hoarding as a kind of OCD related thing. And initially I get my head around that. And then I read a kind of, well, do you check things before you throw them away? And I thought, yes, I do. And I think it's kind of, quite related in that way as well.
Yes, exactly. And that whole OCD, and that comes into perfectionism too. I think the guys, like the guys who started researching hoarding back in the early 90s, Randy Frost and those guys, they first were looking at perfectionism in terms of OCD. And so historically it's been associated with, perfectionism has been associated with compulsivity and doubts and indecisiveness. And that's actually a characteristic of obsessive personalities, but hoarding was thought of as like a subtype of obsessive compulsive personality disorder. That's that kind of Freudian anal sort of restricted person who, you know, who can't let go or whatever. And Randy did some research in the 90s investigating perfectionism and came up with like a scale that had six subscales. So concern over mistakes, personal standards, parental expectations, parental criticism, doubts about actions and organisation. And really when he used that measure on hoarding, on a hoarding group, it was concerns over mistakes, it was parental criticism, which I think is probably that fits as well, and doubts about actions. Yeah. Am I doing the right thing? And, you know, as we know, what is the right thing? It's completely impossible to work that out, you know. So I just find that whole, like the whole change from, okay, hoarding is kind of this obsessive compulsive personality disorder, and then emerging over time as something that's quite separate. It's kind of all very, it's made it all very messy. And I think if we just kind of look at what are the behaviours, it doesn't really matter what we label those behaviours. If we can work on those behaviours that are causing us anxiety and causing disruptions or, you know, difficulties in our lives, that's all that matters. I mean, whether what we call it is really irrelevant.
I fully agree. I think I used to obsess about, funnily enough, getting it exactly right, understanding exactly what was going on, getting the right label, getting the correct. And then, yeah, as you say, over time, I've come to, well, it doesn't really matter whether it falls into that category or that category. What matters is how it affects me and what I can do about it. I remember after someone significant in my life died years ago, I got really obsessed going, is this depression or is this grief? I would feel rotten, obviously. And I remember talking to my GP and saying, well, I feel like this, this, and this. Is that grief or is that depression? And she just went, doesn't matter. Like, you feel awful. That's what matters.
Exactly. And then we've kind of got this whole new kind of psychopathology, complicated grief, which is like when you don't resolve it. It's like, okay, come on, guys, let's just look at how it's affecting us and how we can, what we can do to improve people's lives. Exactly. It's the labels starting to get just so annoying because they all overlap. And that's why we have all these arguments about things. I mean, when you think about like a lot of the major disorders, even those, you know, people argue over whether something's bipolar or whether it's borderline personality. I'm like, oh, please, this is just a waste of paper. But that is what the ivory towers do, isn't it? You know, try to put people in boxes.
Sure. So in one of your email newsletters, you describe perfectionism as a way of being inflexible psychologically. Again, relatable.
Exactly.
How does that relate to hoarding, would you say?
Well, perfectionism is that all or nothing, black or white thinking. You know, it's a very rigid way to see the world. There's no grey, there's right, there's wrong, but there's nothing in between. And for me, this inflexibility in hoarding is kind of seen in that stubbornness and rigidity of following verbal rules that people have and personal narratives as if they're the only alternative. So it's thinking, okay, I can't waste resources at all ever. Waste, not want, not like mum and dad used to say all the time, you know, I'm the only person I know who understands what is happening in our landfills and everyone else is selfish, you know, that kind of really, you know, coming at it from your perspective and your perspective only. Or maybe something, another one I hear sometimes, or when I kind of probe, I get, well, the anxiety is too overwhelming. And there's no way I could ever live without all my stuff. It's just, I have to live this way. I can't change because I can't stand like the agony of regret and guilt and remorse and those things if I were to part with something. And really, I mean, it's not, it's that rigidity of thinking, well, this is the only way my life can possibly be and I have to do things this way. And that comes up so much, of course, with discarding, because there are just so many moving parts to the discarding process in a lot of people's kind of rules that they've devised in order to A, collect stuff and B, you know, discard stuff. And that just really, the perfectionism in that space, just people are just stuck where they are as like, but I can't move either way. And that is where that inflexible psychological, that kind of inflexibility around what's reality, you know, what's actually happening right here and now, because a lot of what is bringing about this rigidity is reflecting back on something that happened in the past. I remember last time that happened, or I remember when I was a child and mum got so mad when I threw out blah and I didn't have one when I needed it. Or in the future, oh gosh, you know, imagine. And you're living in either the past or the future. You're not living here right now, and you're not looking around and going, well, this is, I can't live this way either. So that is that inflexible, that inflexible stance, which it is quite debilitating if you let it be so, because it is so rigid and strict, following rules.
It's interesting. I try sometimes to turn it around and turn that into a strategy almost for certain things to reduce my need to make decisions. So for instance, I have a rule that if food is out of date, it goes in the bin. It doesn't matter if, you know, I could go, well, it's in a tin, so it's probably fine. No, I have a rule. If it's out of date, it goes in the bin. And that makes my life easier.
Yes.
And helps me to de-hoard. But equally, I would say more of how it affects me is in the negative side of it.
Mm.
I was talking to some friends and they were saying, just casually, their recycling bin had been full that week, so they'd put the recycling in the regular bin. I remember thinking, like, ooh, how does that work?
You start hyperventilating. What? Yeah. What did you do?
And it wasn't like judging them for not recycling. It was my mind blowing that they weren't so rigid about it. That just, oh, that happened, so they did this instead. And I thought, how do you just switch like that? I don't get it. So I was thinking in advance of this conversation of some examples of my own perfectionism getting in the way. And something I thought of quite recently that I was able to turn it around, but it took some mental work, was I was going to do some tidying in a particular area of my house. I was all set, and then I decided in my unhelpful brain that I had the wrong kind of bin bags and that stronger, thicker bin bags would be better for this particular task. But they weren't what I had, and obviously I couldn't find them because, you know.
You know.
Exactly.
You know.
And I almost went, oh, well, I can't do this bit of tidying then because I've got the wrong bin bags. I need stronger bin bags than I've got. And I almost abandoned it and went, oh, well, there we are. And thankfully was able to go, no, hold on a sec. Is this really a bad enough problem to abandon the task? And of course it wasn't. It just meant I had to put less in each bin bag so that they were strong enough. But it almost tripped me up, that degree of inflexibility. I had an idea of what I needed and I didn't quite have the resources to do that to hand. And it could well have tripped me up. And certainly that kind of thinking has tripped me up many times. So if somebody who hoards is facing that kind of mental block, what can they do? What should they do?
Well, I think what you described was being a little, and I try to look at things kind of dispassionately as I possibly can and kind of go, okay, well, these are the resources I've got right now. in what way can I combine those resources to make, you know, to be able to do the job that I need to do? And it's all about that kind of being a bit more creative with the thought process rather than here's the rule and that's what I must follow. So, for example, as you were talking, I was thinking, oh, maybe she thought of using two bin bags, you know, one inside another, or maybe she thought, oh, I'll put less in it. Or maybe, you know, she changed her mind and worked on a slightly different area with lighter objects or whatever, you know. So it's that kind of having the mental space and that ability to kind of toss around some ideas and not have that rigid kind of and that anxiety around, I plan to do this and it didn't work out that way, therefore I must stop. I mean, that is what that, and getting over that is kind of, okay, well, this is this is not what I planned. All right, okay, what can I do differently in order to overcome that that hurdle? And I think exactly what you said was the way to get past it is to not beat yourself up about the fact that you don't have the right bags and then go, oh, in a huff. Because really you haven't helped yourself by doing that, and it's just going to give you something else to remind your mind in the night. Oh, well, you were silly. You didn't have the right bin bags, blah, blah. It's a waste of energy, isn't it?
Yeah.
It could have been a waste of time too, because you would have had that time set aside, I'm going to do this particular job.
Yeah.
But you got through it. So, yeah.
I think there's a lot to be said. I think we talked about this a bit last time, to if you have a thought that says no, just ask yourself, rather than accept that no, ask yourself what it's actually about. And then you can start to, often it is something quite easily resolvable, like do I put two bags together? Do I put less in each bag? But if you stop at the no, you never get there. And so I find and this is definitely something I got from CBT, just don't stop at the no, ask yourself what's actually going on and what can I do about it?
Yes, yeah. Because you might ask yourself, you might get a no, and then you kind of go through that process of asking yourself, well, what is it really? And it might be something like, oh, I'm just so thirsty and I haven't had a drink. And I can't think properly without a drink. Okay, I can solve that problem and go and have a drink and then come back and think again. But it might be something physical that you're not, you know, it might not only be in your mind, it might be something physical. And that's one of the things where people often stop. You know, they'll stop at the thought and not think about how they're actually feeling about doing that job. And it might just be a matter of reframing that. And that's what you learn a lot from CBT, is that reframing, looking at it from a different perspective. And that can be done as long as you haven't slipped back into your safety mode that we talked about when I was last on, because that's one of the things that can stop you from having those logical thoughts.
Sure. So in the bigger picture, you say that perfectionism is the reluctance to complete a task or even start a task in order to avoid a less than perfect performance.
Mm-hmm.
I often find myself thinking if I can't do it perfectly, there's no point bothering at all, and have to again talk myself around and kind of challenge that logic. Is that, I mean, we've slightly just covered this, but is that kind of approach something that other people can find helpful?
Yeah, and I think that was that challenging or that reframing your thinking. And if you can do that, that's amazing. That is great. But as I said, some clients will slip down into that turtle mode and their frontal lobes go offline. And I see it happening. I can see it in their face and I can see their eyes glaze over. But if you're able to use logic, it means you're connecting with that decision-making rational mind, which, you know, is a good place to be. But one of the things that makes perfectionism so in hoarding so problematic is that self-criticism, you know, the client beating themselves up with their failures. You know, they have this massive goal of fixing everything up once and for all. you know, bish, bosh, bash, and they prepare themselves like it's a mission, and the second they miss a goal, they give up. I tried, I failed. I won't make that mistake again. I'm not going to try again next time. And, of course, the other problem is lack of confidence, not trying because it's you know, I've never done it before, so I don't believe I can do it this time around, which makes it really a challenge, and that's something that needs to be worked on in therapy with, you know, with a trained therapist, I think.
It's interesting. It's, I don't know if this is an international thing, but here certainly there's a thing every year called Dry January, where people people are encouraged to not drink alcohol for the whole of January.
Ours is Dry July. I think it's because it's winter. Dry July, because it's winter time. Easier to not drink in winter, maybe.
Could be. And I think part of the logic about it being January here is that you've just wrecked your liver over Christmas and New Year, so just let it recover. I had friends who did Dry January this year, and you would see them, you know, for some it was quite hard work. In, you know, the UK we have a big drinking culture, and it's harder than people expect. And I would see there was kind of two approaches to failing. There are people who on January the 15th said sod it and had a glass of wine and would go, that's it, I've ruined it, I'm drinking again. And there would be people who on January the 15th had a glass of wine and went, that's annoying, I had one glass of wine, back on Dry January tomorrow. And of course, by the end of the month, those in the second group had 30 days of not drinking and one of drinking, whereas those in the first group had drunk for half the month. And so obviously being able to say, okay, I messed up there, let's get back on track, is the more productive and useful one. But often, and I suspect a lot of hoarders fall into this trap of going, well, I've failed here, so it's pointless, so I'm giving up.
Exactly. Yeah. And that is often around just experience of not having tackled it before. And if you've done a Dry July or you've done something similar, like, I don't know, a fun run or something, and you say you're going to run every single day and you miss one. I remember in my 20s, I would be like, whoops. Oh, well, that's it. Not doing it. Not doing it. I'm giving up. But I think if you have a bit more of a kind of, it's like a more nebulous kind of agreement with yourself. It's almost like a sort of, it doesn't really have a form, but it's kind of, you're aiming to do Dry January, but it's not, I am not going to drink one day during January. It is again that rigidness, that black and white stuff that comes back. It's right or wrong. I drank or I didn't drink, you know, one glass of wine. Oh, whoops, I'm back on track again. I just think it is. It's that rigidness about a failure as being, you know, not being able to follow the letter of the law that you set down for yourself. But maybe it's better to sort of be a little bit looser with the agreements you make with yourself, or shorter periods of time, or, you know, some other way of dealing. Because the people that tell you they're perfect or tell you that they've done everything right, they only tell you when they've done it right. Trust me, they only tell you when they've done it perfectly. They're not going to tell you when they stuffed up.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's the kind of people they are. You know, they're not going to admit it. If they failed, they'll just tell you they did really well. Which is cheeky, but, you know, there's lots of those people out there.
Absolutely, absolutely. So last time you were on the podcast, we talked in depth about trauma. Is there a connection between trauma and perfectionism?
Yeah, well, I think that the link to trauma, as we spoke about last time, that idea for children with insecure attachment as a result of having a parent with a mental illness or a personality disorder or even just a preoccupied parent, there's that tendency for the child to kind of believe their parents' problems are caused by them. Because developmentally, they're so egocentric, mummy and daddy, often mummy, are sad or angry or rejecting or over-involved or anxious or whatever because of me. So, I mean, that's a great deal of pressure for a young person, for a child of any age. And there's not many ways that they can kind of help their parent. And if they've received attention when they get a high grade, like, or they've remained quiet or done their homework when they were asked or something like that, that means that it's of value. When I do those things for mum or dad. So they attempt to get top marks or do as they're told, help out when other kids are playing, you know, video games or whatever, because this will help mummy and she'll love me more and feel less sad or less angry. And that's kind of where if I'm perfect, then I will be loved and I will be, you know, I won't be rejected. But because it's impossible, you know, it's impossible to manage your parents' or anyone's emotions through your actions. And soon enough, it's not going to work. So mum ignores their test results and or won't get out of bed or whatever. Maybe she has depression or and this is seen as a failure. The kids thinks, oh, I mustn't be perfect or good or worthy enough. I must try harder to be better. I'm not enough. I'm not of value if I'm of only of value if I'm perfect, which I'm clearly not because my parents are still depressed or drinking or angry or whatever. So that instills that idea that if I'm, you know, if I'm perfect, I'm worthy. And I think if you dig under a lot of people who are perfectionists, you'll dig up that I'm not enough, I'm not worthy. It will be under there somewhere. You'll get down to that kind of core belief. But every person has a different definition of what perfect means in their family, and that can, what you know, be widely variant. In a hoarding home, you know, if you have a parent who hoards, being perfect might be, you know, not talking to anybody about what's happening at home, or it might be, you know, not throwing away anything that mum or dad have said not to touch, or you know, not telling mum to move her stuff out of your room because you're expected to have her stuff in there too. That it can be something that's not normally seen as perfection, but in a family that can, it can be quite, it can vary quite significantly. But it's funny because I was just looking at some, looking into this people pleasing or appeasing and the fawning response actually. So, you know, we've got the fight, flight, the freeze, flop, and then there's the other trauma response, which is fawn. So doing whatever we can do to please those close to us so that they accept us and love us and don't abandon us. And I think perfectionism is a manifestation of that, really. And that it is a trauma response, unfortunately. You know, I mean, I think people see it as being a positive, but there is positives, but there's also a lot of negatives.
Two things come to mind when you talk about that. One is, there is sometimes a question that comes up in job interviews, which is like, what are your drawbacks? What do you not do well? Mm. And people will say something that's meant that they try and turn it around and make it sound good. And so say something like, oh, I just want to please all the time, or I just work too hard. They think makes them sound good. And one that I believe people say quite often is, I'm just a perfectionist. It's too difficult for me to do anything wrong. But it's like that, it's not the positive that it sounds like, is it? And
no.
The other thing that comes to mind is that it sounds like you're talking about like a kind of magical thinking. If a teenage girl is having tendencies towards anorexia, then if they just lose another 3 pounds, then their mum will stop being a nightmare. Or if they just lose half a stone, their dad will stop yelling. Or if they can just control that one final thing, then the bullies will stop. You know, it's almost childish.
Mm-hmm.
If I count to 10, the bus will come around the corner, you know, on a less traumatic level. But it's almost childish, but it's totally relatable, I think.
Exactly. And it is in a way childish, but if you, even an adult can have those kind of immature sort of thought processes and emotions around things, because chances are they weren't raised and taught how to manage their own emotions, how to deal with anxiety, how to deal with difficult relationships, all those sorts of things. So, you know, they might be people pleasing someone else, and then they expect their child, for example, to people please, because that's sort of what they're used to. That's how the world works to them. And it does seem, when you break it down and you look at it and you try to rationalize the behavior, it becomes irrational. But you have to actually have that conversation and do the work and look at it for what it is, because all of this stuff is probably happening up here. They've never said it aloud. They've never thought about it, probably. Why do I do these things? And as soon as they are out there in the world, you can turn them over and look at them and see them from different angles and see them from different people's perspectives. And that's why I just think therapy is imperative for anyone who's going through these types of issues. And it doesn't matter what type of perfectionism you suffer from. You might be the ironing undies type, or, you know, or perhaps the chronic procrastinator. I just think unpacking that is really important.
Sure.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
It seems to me like perfectionism might be an entire personality rather than just a behavior. Is it really possible to overcome the limitations that being a perfectionist can impose on somebody?
Yeah, I think genes do play a part in perfectionism. I think there's definitely genetic kind of heredity, but our environment plays a more important role. And if the environment plays a more important role, then that means there's more chances to work on those issues and try and break down that perfectionism. But as I was kind of alluding to before, if you understand your own reasons for your perfectionism, and in hoarding it's likely to be you're a risk evader or you're a procrastinating perfectionist, that is really helpful to make change possible. Because if you know what those behaviours are and the triggers to those behaviours, then you can work on it. You can see it for what it is. And again, it's similar to the dry January sort of stuff. Oh, well, okay, I made a mistake there, but I recognize that I made that mistake. You know, I recognize that I went off the road a little bit, but I'm going to course correct. So there is definitely hope. And often it's CBT or acceptance and commitment therapy, which I think would be definitely something that I would highly recommend for people if they're looking for some type of therapy and they're a perfectionist. But we all have things we have to work on, you know. Everybody has to do some of the work if they want to grow as a person. I mean, it's just that's kind of the reality.
Sure. So if we go back to perfectionism being about inflexibility, how, this is a big one, how can we become more flexible?
we're not talking about the standing bow pose in yoga, are we? We're talking about the ability to be present in the moment with full awareness and openness to our experience and to take action guided by our values. That is the definition of psychological flexibility. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, being in the present moment, open and aware to what's happening, is often quite scary for people. But that's the place we need to get to. That's the way psychologically healthy people live, and that's how they live a full life with meaning and purpose. So I guess my most simple tips, which I probably would say almost every week, is be curious about everything. You know, make that your default stance through practice. I wonder why I feel anxious right now. You know, I wonder why my mother's always ironing her undies, or, you know, what would happen if I told someone I trust about what I'm going through right now? You know, and pondering that and turning that over in your mind, always being curious. And always thinking, well, there must be another way I can do this. It's not one or done. You know, no is not the final answer if I'm attempting to change the way I behave. But experiment, try things out that your mind tells you are not possible for you to achieve. I mean, I'm not talking about flying or becoming a supermodel, or, you know, those have been on my list a few times. I wanted to fly or become a supermodel, but, you know, I'm talking about throwing out a bag or a box that you haven't gone through. Wow, that is freaking radical, man. But be curious and be an experiment. See yeah. how it feels. Even just pondering that thought can be open. You know, that can open you up, flexible, you know, make you more flexible. Could you chuck out a bag that you haven't looked at once a week or once a month? Or could you do it if you peeked in it quickly? What are some of the, you know, how far can you go experimenting and challenging that window of tolerance? I think we've talked about that before as well. You want to be on the edge. You don't want to be over and you don't want to be under, because you're doing yourself an injustice if you're under. But if you're on the edge of your window of tolerance, that means you're just testing yourself outside your comfort zone that tiny little bit. And that's the way we change. It's like the way we build muscle. You know, slowly, and we build. And once you've experimented, try to do a little bit more and then observe how that feels, you know, that just stretching it slowly. But it is a full-time job. I mean, doing the work is kind of, I mean, there's no magic bullet, unfortunately. Magic isn't real, and magical thinking isn't real. I can't telepathically, you know, I can't fix someone else's problems. I can only work with what I've got here myself. But the other thing, which is huge, is working out your values and then taking action towards those. They're key, because a lot of this perfectionism is linked to goals. I mean, goals are good, but they can be achieved. Then what? Always come back to elite athletes. I always think about, you know, swimmers, for example. From a very young age, life revolves around going off to the pool really early in the morning, training, swim meets. But what happens if that child gets injured and can't swim again, or doesn't grow huge feet like Ian Thorpe, or, you know, or what if the miracle happens and they get to the Olympics and win gold? What now? You know, it's like you're hanging there. But if we kind of live by our values that we've chosen, we never fail. We never go wrong. And there's always something we've done to be proud of. And one of the key things that clients, I often say to clients, you know, we're not our roles. We're not our jobs. We're much more than that. And, you know, one of the questions that is quite confronting but can really help open yourself up to values is, what do you want people to say about you in your eulogy? What do you want to be remembered for? What will they say? If they'll say she kept a really tidy house and her jocks were folded like an origami crane, then maybe, you know, don't you want to be remembered for being a kind, inspirational person who was tolerant and you know, and loving. I don't know. I mean, it's up to you how you want to live, but values are what will pull you through. Goals are fine, but, you know, they can be achieved, and then what? What do I do now?
Yeah. I think there's something about trying to shake off the rigidity in a way that you have a safety net. So,
yes.
When I got my first car, I was a very nervous driver. And so what I did for a while was make myself drive every day to get the hang of it. And so if I didn't have anywhere to go, I basically created like a 30-minute round trip. So if I didn't have anywhere to go, I would just drive this particular 30 minutes every day. And then as I was feeling more confident with that, I would extend it a bit or change it a bit and go a bit further. And then over time, as my confidence was growing, I started, against all my usual rigidity, going, do you know what? I'm just going to drive. I'm just going to go where the car takes me. That road looks interesting. I'll go down there. And I had my safety net was my GPS, my sat nav, that wherever I drove to, my sat nav could get me back home. And so I would just go, I'm going to follow that bus for 5 minutes, or I'm going to turn down here and see what happens. And it felt really liberating to not be on a course, but instead to just be going where my whims took me. And the reason I could do it was because I knew that my phone knew how to get me back home afterwards. I have the worst sense of direction. I wouldn't have done it myself. And the only kind of, oh my God, thing that really happened was once when I ended up on a motorway. I was like, okay, this is going to be a bit of a longer trip than I planned. But even that,
the next off ramp, how can I?
I just got off at the next exit, and you know, when it was safe to pull over, did that, and then programmed my address into my phone, and it got me home. And back on the motorway in the other direction. But yeah, and I feel like if you've got an equivalent of the GPS in your home, so you've got some kind of safety net, and that will be different, I expect, for different people, then trying to have that kind of controlled chaos to some degree can be really, really helpful and a bit liberating and scary, of course, but actually quite productive.
I love that analogy. I love that. I love it. I love it. I love it. Because that is that is just kind of encapsulating what we're talking about. That is this, as you say, if you've got some sort of a safety net, and I'm not quite sure what that would be, but that's something that you can work through, you know, with your therapist or with the person who's helping you. What will be that safety net? How can you feel secure to take that step forward, be that little bit more adventurous, take that, because it is liberating. I mean, just thinking about what it was like when I first got my license, the same thing. Wow, I want to go and get an ice cream. All right, I can go and do that. And that's the sort of thing that we want, you know, we want people to be able to do in their lives with everything. And it's not only around your stuff, it's everything. We want you to, you know, be able to take those little cautious steps outside of what you know, because there is the tendency, if you don't take those little steps, that, you know, things can close in over time, can't they? I mean, things start to get smaller, smaller. So if we can keep people opening, you know, opening out, and that's what I like to talk to people about, just that opening up a little bit at a time. And chances are, you know, you'll look back and think, wow, look how far I've come. My goodness.
Yeah. And if you can work out what your safety net is, whether that is, I don't know if I want to get rid of all these childhood letters, or maybe my safety net is taking a photo of them all so I've got records if I feel like I'll regret it later, It could be, as you say, it could be anything really. But if you can work out what that thing is for you, and then just, like you were saying earlier, be curious, experiment. Okay, what happens if I do? Let's test out throwing out something you might regret, just in a very controlled, just one thing, and see what happens. And see, first of all, if you do regret it. And secondly, if you do, is it as bad as you think it's going to be? Is that feeling of regretting throwing something out the worst thing in the world? Or is it more of a niggle that actually a few days later or a few weeks later you've forgotten about? Does it matter as much as you think it will?
Because there is that tendency. We do think that negative emotions or negative things are going to go on forever. We're scared to let our emotions run wild because we may never be able to pull ourselves back in. But, you know, a panic attack will subside. The grief will never go away, but it will change. It changes form, you know, all of these things happen. And the regret of throwing something away, I think we tend to think we're going to regret letting go of something, but what we actually regret is not doing the things that we wanted to do in life. That is a bigger regret than letting something go.
Yeah.
And that scary feeling of not trying something or not doing all we could to achieve something or living in a life that we want to live, I think that regret is what will, you know, you'll be talking about with your family when you're old and grey, saying, I didn't manage to achieve that, or I didn't manage to, you know, find that person and apologize, or I didn't manage to, I don't know, fill the space here. But yeah, I think that regretting what you haven't done rather than regretting something you did do.
Yeah.
Possibly worse.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, answering, I found with what if questions, answering that question. I remember being in a supermarket going, do I want like mushroom soup for tea or chicken soup for tea? What if I get the wrong one? What if I get mushroom soup and then later think, I wish I'd got chicken soup? And then if I force myself to answer that question, then I go, well, what? I just have a slightly disappointing meal. You know, it's not it's not worth the agony I've been giving this in my head. But what if? Yeah, what if? Yeah. What if I get the wrong soup? It doesn't matter. Yeah.
And with what if you got the right one? What if you got the right one and it was the best meal in the world? You know, what if I took that, you know, that trip in my car and I ended up somewhere and I, you know, I don't know, I had the best coffee I'd ever had? Or, you know, we always think of what if in a negative, but what if, you know, what if this is the next step towards the best thing? It might be the next step towards something bad, but it might not be as well.
Yeah. And yeah. And similarly with discarding, what if I throw this away and regret it? What if I throw it away and regret it? Is it really the worst thing in the world? And sometimes, that, you know, I have thrown things away and regretted it and it's felt horrible for ages. But I've also thrown things away and slightly regretted it, but not been that bothered.
And I've thrown things away and I cannot remember what the heck it was I threw away. Yeah. Most of the time. Occasionally, unlike you, occasionally I think, oh, that'd be, you know, it'd be nice to have that right now. But I think people, we are so much more adaptable and inventive than we think we are. So we think we need the perfect, you know, I don't know, paperclip for this type of paper or whatever. But, you know, at the end of the day, we really don't need to have all these specially designed things for every individual purpose. We're pretty inventive. And a lot of people forget that. They're like, oh, but what if I need it? Yeah, if you need it, you'll use a screwdriver or you'll use something else, you know. I think it's a shame that we don't feel confident in ourselves enough that we can invent, you know, ways of doing things. We think we need the perfect tools.
Completely, completely. And we are very inventive. I think most people are. For some reason, the terrible example that comes to mind is when I used to smoke. I haven't smoked for a long while now, but I remember as a student when we were all broke and this was the 90s, everybody smoked. And one of my friends ran out of cigarettes and rolled his own, but using tea leaves from a tea bag. And he was just so desperate to smoke that that was the best he could come up with. And of course, it was terrible and he never did it again. But it was so inventive. Like, I need some kind of leaves that I can put into a, you know, a tube and set fire to. And I don't know why that's the example that's come to mind. But we are very, you know, if you think about, you're really hungry and the only things that are in your fridge don't seem to go together, but you pull together the best meal you've ever had.
Exactly. And that's how new recipes are invented. That's how new things come about, you know. Ottolenghi, he's there in his test kitchen throwing things that they find in the fridge together and then it's like this amazing meal. And you think, well, that's how things happened. And being curious and inventive, I mean, that's kind of what we were built for, really. And if we let ourselves, it's just letting yourself, it's fear of failure in a big way. You know, if I stuff it up and it doesn't happen the way I want it to happen, well, then I've failed. But really, failure is where you learn. I mean, that's the only way you can learn is if you fail at something and then you adapt to it. I just think that's just huge.
Yeah. And back to having the wrong bin bags. What if I use the wrong bin bag? What if I use the wrong bin bag? What if this bin bag isn't strong enough for this rubbish? Then I tear a bin bag and try again when I find the strong bin bags. There are no outcomes of that are terrible. There are some that are slightly annoying.
Yeah.
And there are some that are fine.
Exactly. You've still sorted it and it's still in a bag. You might not be able to move the bag because if you pick it up it might rip, but then but I've sorted it now and it's done. That is done now. I know that I want those things to go. Yeah, I think there is a lot of there's a lot of fear of failure in all of us. And it's that, well, what if I fail? Well, what if you don't?
Completely. Completely. And it's something I try. I default to it so often, and I'm really trying lately to challenge it with exactly this kind of stuff we've been talking about.
Yeah, and the only way to do it is just do it again and again, just try to challenge again and again and again and again. And chances are your mind will still go there. You know, your mind will still probably slip back there and you can just go, thanks for that, but, I'm going to just go with my inventive way of doing it. I'm not going to follow the rules anymore. Because it will probably pop up with, it's hard to stop thoughts. I mean, thoughts are just there. They just come up. But we don't have to do what they tell us because they're not capital T true. I mean, they're just a reality of what's going on in our mind. And sometimes they're pretty rude. I mean, sometimes they say pretty nasty stuff. And really, that's not helping anybody, is it?
Yeah, for sure. And if we can reframe it as I've got to do this right into I'm just being really rigid here for no good reason.
And it took me a long time. I mean, I'm a recovering perfectionist. I'm one of those people that would rush around making sure that everything was perfect. And I'd be so anxious if I noticed that, when my friends came around that there was a spot on the window or something. And I just had to slowly test my ability to live with a little bit of mess. Oh, I'll let that happen. I'll leave that there. No one's going to die if I don't do the washing right this minute.
Yeah.
And just slowly let myself be more flexible over time. And yeah, I'm certainly not cured, but I'm recovering, definitely, I think I can say. Definitely a recovering perfectionist.
Work in progress.
Work in progress, yeah. And we all are. We all are work in progress.
Definitely.
Until we kick the bucket.
Well, thank you so much. As ever, you're full of amazing insights and it is much appreciated.
Awesome. Thanks for having me again.
You are very welcome. I will put links to your website and all your social medias online in the show notes. So check those out to find more about Jan. And I recommend subscribing to her email newsletter in particular.
Yes, excellent. Please come on board. Join all the other happy campers.
In just 1 second, I'll give you my top tip of the week. In the meantime, please do subscribe to the podcast, review it, 5 stars would be amazing, and share it with your friends or anyone who might be interested or who might benefit from it. It all really helps. To find out more ways to support the website, the podcast, and my overall de-hoarding project, go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/support. Now, back to your top tip.
My top tip this week is to allow yourself to fail. Let it happen rather than demanding, as we've been talking about this whole episode, rather than demanding perfection of yourself, give yourself permission to do it wrong. Once you've allowed that and you can relax into it a bit, you'll be able to get a lot more done. All right, thank you for listening and I will speak to you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding podcast. You can find more online at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. You can find me on Twitter at ThatHoarder and on Facebook at Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with ThatHoarder. To find out more about how you can support this podcast and the overall project, go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/support. And do subscribe to this podcast so you make sure you don't miss any future episodes.
Now on Broadway, An Enemy of the People is a New York Times critic's pick. Jeremy Strong is one of the great actors of his generation, hails the Chicago Tribune in a performance the Wall Street Journal praises as powerfully affecting and bitterly funny. Michael Imperioli sets off sparks, cheers the Hollywood Reporter. Victoria Pedretti is luminous, raves variety. From director Sam Gold and playwright Amy Herzog, An Enemy of the People is urgent, electrifying, and haunting, declares USA Today. An Enemy of the People on Broadway through June 16th only.